Thank you to the thousands of emails I'm getting with Stephen Meyer tonight. He is good. We'll be back. We'll take your calls now this hour on Coast to Coast AM. You know, when you read all the ancient stories, Stephen, Greek mythology of the 12 gods, ancient texts, the Sumerians, I guess you have to conclude that something very dramatic happened on this planet a long time ago, something that a lot of people just don't understand, you know?
Well, there's, as I mentioned earlier, a long-standing intuition with most people that there is a purpose of intelligence behind the order in the cosmos and the special features of living systems. And that is what I find fascinating, is that these long-standing philosophical questions that have been with us at least since the ancient Greeks, questions like, is the universe finite or infinite? Is life the result of purely material processes, or did an intelligent, conscious agent play a role in the origin of life? Is it designed or undesigned? Those are philosophical questions that have gone back very far in human history. And in the last 100 years, even the last 50 to 20 years, there have been discoveries in science that have enabled us to address those questions. In cosmology, we were talking earlier about the origin of the universe. We now have very good reason to believe, because of things that have been discovered in the night sky, that the universe is expanding outward from a beginning point back in time, that the universe itself is finite, not infinite in time and in space. And likewise in biology, this great question of design or no design is something that can now be addressed because of modern scientific discoveries.
Indeed. Let's take some calls. You ready?
You bet.
Let's go to Grants Pass, Oregon. Keith, west of the Rockies. Hi, Keith. Good morning.
Hi. How are you doing tonight?
We're well, thanks.
All right. I was wondering, I heard that earthworms are one gene away from human.
No, I don't think that's quite right. There are
maybe some humans.
Yeah, maybe some.
Okay.
There are similarities in many genes and in lots of different organisms. But you, for example, humans and chimps are said to have 99% similar genetic makeup. But that number is dropping as we learn more about the genomes of the two species. But in addition, we're now learning that the non-coding regions of the genome, which are not considered in those comparisons and calculations, are critical. They're not junk, but they perform functions, and important functions. As I mentioned, overall, the non-coding regions of the genomes in organisms function like the operating system in a computer that tells the coding regions when to turn on and off, and those sections of the genome are species specific. So the long-standing argument has been, well, similarity in genes shows common ancestry, but we now know that these critical regions of the genome that are responsible for determining which parts of the coding DNA is going to be operative in any given setting, that those parts, that operating system, is different from species to species and therefore undercuts this long-standing argument for universal common ancestry.
There you go, Keith. Okay?
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay, you got it. Awesome. Let's go to Terry in California, first-time caller. Hi, Terry.
Thank you for having me. I wanted to mention, I was compelled to call. Your theory to me, Steve, or your findings are interesting, but I don't think they make a case for a God any more than they do that there's intelligent design. It can come from any other source. I think one of the resistance that people have to the intelligent design is that the concept, because the religious zealots, especially right-wing religious zealots, despise Darwin, the whole concept of evolution, that it's been commandeered. The whole intelligent design has been sort of attached to a religious, fanaticism in a sense, and that's a problem you have with it. And I think it's more of a secular theory, because I mean, okay, let's accept that there's an intelligent design. It doesn't necessarily mean it comes from a God. When you mention that, I mean, the gods could be the space, it could be Eric von Däniken again. I mean, it's the fact that whoever introduced this intelligent design could be from anywhere. It doesn't have to be some guy in a gray beard, where is God? Where does God live anyway? And one other question I'm saying is, even Jesus, he flew up into the air, I mean, you could just make a case that it, the visitors from outer space is just as plausible. I'm not even adhering to that theory. I'm just saying you can't say for sure either what caused it. And I think you'd be better off treading on secular grounds if you want more people to accept the notion.
All right, get your reaction.
Well, that's a great point. I think you'll like my book then. That's exactly how I argue the case. It's on secular scientific grounds that you can make the case for intelligent design. I mentioned before the method of reasoning that Darwin used. His great mentor was the early geologist Charles Lyell, who pioneered, along with Darwin, this method of studying the distant past in a scientific manner. And he had a maxim. He said, when we're trying to explain an event in the remote past, we should be looking for a cause now in operation, a cause known to produce the effect in question. And my case for intelligent design is based on that, if you will, secular scientific method. What's the cause known to produce information? People ask me, who do I think the designing intelligence is? Because of some of the deliberations that I've had, and for the reasons I specified before, I favor the idea that the designing intelligence is most likely God, and I believe in God, and so that is a conclusion that provides support for that belief. But the basic case for intelligent design infers that a designing intelligence of some kind played a role in the origin of life and information because of what we know about the cause and effect structure of the world. And then there's a second order question as to the identity of the designing intelligence. I think for the reasons I shared with George before, I favor the God hypothesis over the space alien hypothesis, but people are free to draw their own conclusions, of course.
Okay, next up we go to Houston, Texas, east of the Rockies. Karen, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, in the direction that you're going and studying what we're made at the molecular level, how close do you think we're going to get to understanding, disease that just, it just vanishes once somebody has it, and then it's just gone, like, instantaneously? And also the kundalini energies and things like this, and spontaneous human combustion. This has to be at the cellular level. Or at least at DNA level, right?
Well, I guess I'm not familiar with some of the phenomena you described, but clearly the study of not just DNA, but also the whole genome and the way that, not just DNA, but the way the organism processes, stores, and organizes information is, I think, going to shed a lot of light on the study of disease and a lot of progress is being made in that area. So,
oh, okay. And I've got one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
What were the dinosaurs for?
my personal view is that they were for the infinite amusement of 4-year-old boys many millions of years later. I started out as a dinosaur nut as a kid. And
adults, too.
And adults, too. Fascinating. The airport I most love to go through is Chicago O'Hare, because you get to see that Brachiosaurus replica right there in the middle of the terminal. So, I think they're fascinating creatures that... that obviously well designed as well. Great structures.
In all your work that you've done, primarily, Stephen, in this direction for, as you said, the last 25 years, where do you think the next 10, 15 years will go with this?
Well, let me hearken back to the story I told about my computer programmer friend, because he said something very interesting. He said that, when we look at all these design patterns, these design strategies in the living cell, that he got an eerie feeling that someone figured this out before him. Turns out that's a very important insight, not just about the origin of life, but actually where we go forward with research. We know something about how computer programmers design information processing systems. We know about design strategies that are used by electrical and mechanical engineers. We can see that the cell is using an information processing system. And since we know something about the way designing agents do things, we can anticipate certain design strategies or patterns in living systems, and we can go out and look for them. And we can predict that they may be there. And we can devise ways of reverse engineering the cell and coming to an understanding of how it works more quickly if we presuppose
that it was designed. And in other words, if it really is designed and we approach it with that assumption, there are going to be some things we'll be looking for that will actually advance scientific research and will be more what scientists say heuristically fruitful, will be a better guide to discovery than the old Darwinian idea that things arose by an undirected trial and error process. One of the first predictions that the theory of intelligent design made, which has been borne out, is that the non-coding regions of the genome, the so-called junk, would not be junk. It would not be revealed to be junk, but rather replete with function. And that prediction has now been confirmed amply by a number of discoveries, most recently by the publication of the results of the ENCODE project. So a lot of times people will say intelligent design has no value for science, it's a science stopper, or it isn't science because it doesn't make predictions or can't be tested. But just the very opposite is the case, and we have in the network of scientists around the country who are doing research on intelligent design, and in our own lab in the Seattle area, a number of experimental projects going on that are based on the assumption that we're looking at a design system, and therefore we ought to be expecting certain sorts of features to be manifest, and we're going out and looking for them, and there are various predictions that are being made that I think are going to prove very fruitful for science.
Indeed. New York City, New York, Don on the wildcard line. Hello, Don. Thanks for calling.
Great show, George. Listen to you on 610 CKTV out of Canada.
Great.
I wanted to ask your guest a two-part question. How small is small? Originally, when they discovered the atom, they thought that was the smallest particle, and then they kept getting smaller and smaller. What is your research pointing to? Are we ever going to find a finite point on that? And second part is, how does this relate to other dimensions, fourth dimensions, fifth dimensions, and subatomic theories?
Well, the nanotechnology that I'm describing inside the cell is measured in angstroms. It's small, but it's not as small as those atoms or subatomic particles that you're talking about. That's another layer, telescoping down further, if you will. And that's a fascinating area of physics because when you divide the atom, which literally comes from the Greek word, the uncuttable, you find something smaller, and you get to this paradoxical realm where the smallest things behave like both waves and particles. And a colleague of mine, George Gilder, has said that at the heart of matter lies a mystery, that we don't really the material realm. You finally get to a wave and a wave of information. So there's the mystery of physics. There's a lot of mysterious things in physics that I think are also undermining what I would call a materialistic worldview. And so that's a realm of even smaller dimensions, but maybe larger mysteries.
Do you sometimes look at the angelic realm as well, Stephen, life after death and those possibilities?
Well, I mentioned this isn't really part of the theory of intelligent design, but I did mention earlier in the show I am a believing Christian, and
yes.
So I take the Bible as telling us about some aspects of reality that can't be directly verified by human experience or science, but it is a revelation of God, and because there are, I think, so many good reasons to believe it that can be verified, I take on faith those parts that can't be, and I suppose those realms that you just mentioned are fall within that category.
Next up, let's go to San Diego. Tim, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Timmy.
George, congratulations on a great program tonight, and Dr. Meyer, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I was wanting to ask you about Charles Darwin's actual scientific sincerity in writing The Origin of Species and proposing a mechanistic solution for the design problems that he perceived in nature. He already knew from the selective breeding experiments and practices of farmers and cattle herders that there was an upper limit to the amount of change that could be developed in any line of living creature by selective breeding. Yet, in spite of that, he attempted to extend the method of natural selection to trans-specific dimensions. In other words, amoebas turning into astronomers. And he knew other things as well, developed by his grandfather Erasmus, who included many of the, in fact, practically all of the same types and items of information that he included in the Origin, including biogeography and competition. The only thing that his grandfather missed was the Malthusian synthesis. And yet Charles gave no credit to his grandfather's work in any of his publications. Darwin was under intense pressure from his father to achieve, to become one of the stellar lights in intellectual England at that time. His father sent him to medical school. Charles didn't like medicine.
He didn't like medicine much. You're absolutely
and,
right.
And he sent him tried to get him to become a clergyman, and sent him, I guess, to seminary. And Charles didn't like that. And then even after the pioneering work that Charles did on the Beagle, it was still another 20 years before he published. Surely he was aware of the weakness of his arguments. He had to know. I mean, he did not even attempt to get his notes organized into book form for the Origin until after Alfred Russel Wallace looked like he was going to scoop Charles. And then Charles, in a panic, threw the book together, and he was competing with Wallace for equal time before the Royal Society to present papers on natural selection. And I just think that Charles was basically a college frat boy of the 19th century, who was a point man in developing another naive 19th century philosophy that has since gone into the dustbin, along with Fabian socialism and communism and other failed 19th century philosophies. It's just, it's amazing that this kind of thing could be promoted in academia in our supposedly more enlightened age, don't you think?
Well, a long question. I agree with you about the scientific point about the limitations on breeding experiments. They were well known in the 19th century. They're well known today. And the move Darwin made to try to overcome that known limitation was to propose that with enough time, you could extrapolate the rather small and modest effects that were visible in artificial selection to in a natural setting to accomplish the large scale transformations in form that his theory required. The problem that he didn't really understand at that time was the problem of generating new information, the information you need for every innovation in form. Form requires information in biology. And there was an interesting book edited a couple years ago, edited collection of academic scientific papers published by MIT Press, titled On the Origin of Organismal Form. And the biologist who wrote the introductory chapter listed a number of things that remained unsolved since to the present day, since the writing of The Origin, and it was a rather formidable list, but one of them was the origin of form, the origin of novel form. It's one thing to get small variations, but another to get brand new organisms.
Let's come back and take final phone calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's our show, so you don't want to miss it. When we come back, let's take final phone calls with Stephen Meyer, author of Signature in the Cell, on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, is science actively going out there to try to find this God particle, to try to figure out exactly what is going on in this universe?
Well, scientists are trying to make sense of reality like everybody else, and there are certain methods that they use to do so. The God question doesn't arise in every branch of science by any means. There's lots of kind of pedestrian science that's concerned with, say, how one molecule interacts with another, chemical reactions, the
finding the formulas for various substances, the forces of physics, and so forth. But I think the God question arises from a consideration of the big issues in science, certainly the big origins questions, the origin of the universe, the origin of life.
We may never get the answers. You know that.
Well, you know, we may, but it's also surprising how much we've learned that points in a God-friendly direction. And the other thing that I'm struck with, having studied the history and the philosophy of science, is that the assumptions that scientists make about the uniformity of nature, about the intelligibility of nature, which was one of the key ideas that got science going in the period of Newton and just before, these assumptions flowed out of a Judeo-Christian's worldview, if you will. The idea that the universe was designed by an irrational agent, which made it intelligible, which made it something we could study and in a way that would yield fruit, that we could make sense of it. This is in a way the heritage of an earlier way of looking at the reality that's being, I think, vindicated by recent discoveries in science that are pointing once again to the need for designing intelligence behind it all.
This is a little bit like the global warming situation, where one camp believes that it's man-made, another, including me, believes that this planet is in a cycle. With intelligent design, there seems to be still some hostility, is there?
Absolutely. There's an ideological element to this debate, just as there is with the global warming debate. And many people have the false stereotype of science still lingering in their minds, maybe from eighth grade science, that science is always just about the facts. There's a bunch of men and women in white lab coats that read the data, and the theory just becomes obvious, and there's no need to argue. There's no assumptions involved. There's no implications that might upset ideological commitments. But it doesn't work like that. And there are many scientific studies that are essentially fairly neutral with respect to these larger questions. But there are other scientific topics like origins or topics, the other one you mentioned. It's interesting. There's a very large number of well-qualified scientists who have signed a statement of dissent from both the human-caused global warming hypothesis and neo-Darwinism, and some of the scientists are on both lists and trading names and numbers. So the public is right to be skeptical of the scientific consensus always being presented as an established a fact or fait accompli. And this happened to intelligent design partly because of the result of some premature publicity that we received back in 2005, when a little tiny school district in Dover, Pennsylvania, attempted to mandate a discussion of intelligent design. Many of the people behind that were actually probably young Earth creationists who were had a different agenda, but they were using intelligent design to kind of advance their agenda. They justified it with an explicit statement of religious purpose, which no judge in the country would accept. The ACLU jumped in. We advised the school board, please don't do this. Withdraw this policy. It's a train wreck waiting to happen.
Right.
And what happened was that the national media jumped in and said, hey, we've got in the making a new scopes trial. And so there was a kind of stigma associated with intelligent design because of that trial and the media coverage of it. And what I've tried to do in this book is fill in the gaps in public understanding that have resulted because of that premature and inaccurate media coverage, and show that there's a tremendous scientific basis for this conclusion, one that wasn't addressed by the judge in the trial. Nowhere in the trial did he discuss the DNA evidence for intelligent design. And get people. I'm trying to open people's minds. It's a kind of, you've heard it said, but there's a lot more to say. And basically, the message of the book is it isn't over after Dover. ID is back, and it's back with a vengeance, because there's a tremendous wealth of scientific data behind this conclusion.
To the phones we go now. We'll go to Cincinnati, Ohio. First time caller, George. Good morning.
Good morning, and this is a fantastic show.
Thank you.
I'd like to say, isn't there a sort of a connection with what you're saying with Descartes And what Descartes was saying was, I think, therefore I am. What he is saying basically is that proof of existence is thought, okay? And God is, according to the Bible, the great I am, okay? He was the Word and the Light, okay? So that God, I think Descartes was even in his supposedly anti-religious, or he was part of the scientific movement, he was recognizing the existence of God is the great I am, the creator, because he compares man. Man is was created in the image of God, okay? And even in the Bible it says, Christ was saying, I am that you say I am, okay? He couldn't say what he was, but he was saying, I am, which in effect was, he was saying, I include God in me. Everyone has a little bit of a spark of God in them, okay?
Sure.
Even if you don't believe in Christ as is God, or the image of God, he supposedly God created man in his image, okay? But it's an imperfect image.
Well, a couple things to say. First, Descartes, the French philosopher, was actually a theist who was trying to prove the existence of God. Most philosophers don't think his proofs were very strong, but he is known, as you correctly note, for his insight that the thing that we know before we know anything else is that we know that we are thinking conscious agents. We know the existence and power of our own minds better than we know anything else. And one of the ironies of modern 20th century science, 19th century science in particular, was that the scientists that materialistic science tried to eliminate consciousness and mind and agency as fundamental realities in our description of reality. And yet that's something we know better than anything else. And intelligent design is in part based on that observation that mind is a irreducible aspect of reality and that it has certain powers to produce certain kinds of effects. And the principal thing that we know it produces is information. One of the early molecular biologists or information scientists who applied information theory to molecular biology, a man named Henry Quassler, made an interesting observation. He said that information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And that's the message of my book, that the information that we know exists within the DNA molecule must be the result of intelligent design, because we know that information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And that does dovetail, I think, nicely with the biblical tradition, which sees that the fundamental thing that gets everything else going is not just matter and energy, but it is actually the Word which precedes everything else. So I speak there again as a Christian rather than as an ID theorist, because there are many people who accept ID who are not Christians or religious people. But as a Christian, I do see a connection to the idea that in the beginning was the Word, and the realization scientifically that the fundamental thing that runs the show in life and which would have had to have been there from the beginning is information.
Okay, next up, we go to Lexington, Kentucky. Rick is with us. Rick, go ahead.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Norrie.
Hi.
I have a question for the guest.
He's ready to go.
About Charles Darwin. What do you know about his grandfather, Eremus, who was a member of the Lunar Society, who wrote a book called Zoonomia in 1794, where he outlined the very same opinions that Charles Darwin formed in his life?
Huh.
Previous guest, or caller, rather, I'm the guest, I guess, previous caller alluded to that Erasmus was also a staunch evolutionist and a materialist in his philosophy. What Charles added to his grandfather's thinking was the critical notion of natural selection, which, as I mentioned, is a real process in nature that has some discernible powers or effects. The question, of course, is: does natural selection have all the creative powers that have been attributed to it? I'm skeptical about that. I don't know about the other aspects of Erasmus's biography that you mentioned. I haven't done a lot of historical work on that, but I do know that Darwin came from a legacy. he had a legacy in his grandfather of earlier evolutionary thinking that he built upon.
Yeah, somebody had to help push him in the direction he went.
Yeah, absolutely. And these ideas were in the water in the 19th century. The philosophy of the 18th century was very much skeptical about the existence of God. The Enlightenment philosophers and the scientists in the 19th century picked that up with materialistic theories of origins, and Darwin's being the most famous and the most influential over time. But as I argue in the book, I think the central idea of Darwin's thinking, his central intellectual legacy, that there is no evidence of design in the universe, is no longer tenable. And in fact, the thing for which I admire him, the scientific method he developed, it can be applied to all the new things that we've discovered, and when it is applied to the new discoveries of molecular and cell biology and the discovery of digital code and DNA, we come to a very different conclusion about the origin of life than Darwin did. In fact, we come to the conclusion of design.
Okay, next up we go to TJ in Tucson, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Hi, TJ.
Yes, sir. In regards to the Big Bang theory, the universe should be shrinking, but with the finding that it's expanding and accelerating at the same time. Well, if you read in the Bible, 300 years after the flood of Noah in the days of Peleg, God says he's stretched out the universe. Could it be that the fact that the universe is accelerating and there's no explanation for it be that God is still accelerating or stretching out the universe, and that's part of his calling card that he does exist?
I have a colleague who's a philosopher of physics who thinks exactly that. The technical term is the cosmological constant, but that's said to be responsible for the expansion of the universe and its accelerating rate of expansion. But as with many fundamental forces in physics, we often give names to the forces we name what we don't really understand, and we don't know what's really causing the expansion. It's completely mysterious, but we can quantify it, and we give a name for the entity which is said to be causing it, but we really have no direct access to what the cosmological constant actually is. So, I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to understand things from a theistic point of view.
Who created the designer?
That is a question that is often put to people who argue for intelligent design. It's thought by Richard Dawkins to be a knockdown, drag-out argument against intelligent design because it creates what he terms an infinite. He alleges that it creates an infinite regress, but. What he wants to say is that if you have to invoke a designer to explain the origin of complexity in life, the designer must be more complex than the complexity that you invoked, and therefore you have this infinite regress. But I think I actually rebut Richard Dawkins fairly exhaustively in the 17th chapter of my book, and. Because Dawkins' own principle undercuts his own idea. You could just as easily say to Dawkins, well, who evolved the evolver? He wants to say that any time one explanation requires a deeper explanation, that the initial explanation is therefore not valid. But that's not the case. We can identify the cause of an event and still want to know what the cause of the cause is. He acknowledges that there is he believes in biological evolution, but acknowledges that there's no explanation for the origin of life. So his principle is just as explanation is just as subject to that problem as the theory of intelligent design. In addition, every system of thought has to start somewhere. Every worldview has what philosophers call an ultimate or a prime reality. Every worldview affirms the existence of a thing from which everything else comes. And Dawkins is a materialist, so he affirms that matter and energy are the fundamental things from which everything else comes. I'm not. I'm a theist. I think God is the fundamental thing from which everything else comes. The question is, especially in light of the new cosmology, in light of the Big Bang theory and general relativity, which have established that if you go back far enough in time, you get to a singularity in time and space. The question is, what is the fundamental? What's the better candidate to be the fundamental thing from which everything else comes? I think, in light of the new cosmology, that matter is
a bad candidate to be the that prime reality, and therefore I think it's not at all disreputable to invoke at the very beginning an unmoved mover, an eternal self-existent intelligent designing God, as opposed to a self-existent material condition, especially since we know that the universe began a finite time ago.
Okay, let's go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Jeff, let's get you in. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, George. Hi, Stephen. My question to you, Stephen, is how come 99% of all species go extinct, 99% of all life forms fail before they reach reproductive age? How come the intelligent designer doesn't solve cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, spina bifida? How come about 90% of the Earth's existence was inhospitable to multicellular life? How come it took the intelligent designer to about a billion years to go from prokaryotes to eukaryotes? How come 60 to 80% of human pregnancies end in miscarriages? Basically, it's the dysteleological argument against an intelligent designer and for maybe an incompetent designer.
Yeah, great question. The question of dysteleology is a big topic. There's a number of different cases, I think, and they have to be taken one by one. There's a number of cases of so-called bad design that aren't bad design. The vertebrate retina, for example, is claimed to be an instance of bad design, but it's actually a very good example of what's called of an elegant trade-off in engineering, constrained optimization, where you're balancing a number of design objectives in a very elegant fashion. Then there are cases where you have clear degradation of an original design, and that is, I think, what you find in many cases of disease, and where you can tell the difference between what was originally designed and what has decayed by mutation since then. I think the thing to say there, same as with extinction, just because you have something decay over time does not obviate the conclusion of an original design. You may have an automobile that has rust on it, but that doesn't disprove that the internal combustion engine was designed by a very good engineer. Signs of decay are not necessarily a refutation of design. There is, of course, a theological question about why God would allow such a thing, but my book and the theory of intelligent design does not address that. The theologians have addressed those questions down through the ages, and I suppose I wouldn't be a Christian if I didn't think there were some good answers to those things, but they go beyond the scope of intelligent design.
Stephen, good luck with the book, Signature in the Cell, and your work, my friend.
Thank you for having me on and for all the great questions from your callers. What an intelligent audience you have.
Oh, they are the best. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.